I know he's at first. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of You Have Tread on Me Radio. Today is Monday, the 4th of April, 2011. And tonight our guest is going to be Gary Hunt with us. We're going to be talking about whether cops are constitutional or not. Is law enforcement even constitutional? We're going to be looking into this subject and try to figure out if what we have today is even or has ever been part of our law. So, Gary, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Just fine. It's nice and sunny down here in California for a change. We got rid of all that rain.
That's good.
And so I'm ready to go. It's nice. I don't have to have the heater on. So anyway, we're going to talk about constitutional. Let me give you a little searching something else for another article. And I ran across an article, a paper that was done by a fellow named Roger Roots. Now, he's got an interesting background. He's got a doctorate of jurisprudence, a master in jurisprudence. He graduated from School of Law in 1999, Dr. William Social Justice in 2000, and Montana State University in 1995. He is a former federal prisoner and founder of the Prison Crisis Project.
Hey, we seem to be breaking up really bad. We had problems with the system just a few minutes ago, and it seems as if we're still having some problems. You're breaking up really bad, Gary. Maybe I'm even breaking up. I don't know.
Okay, well, I don't know where I got cut off. I was giving background on the fellow that wrote this paper. Did all of that come across?
You might actually want to start over because very shortly into what you were saying, it dropped out. You were breaking up, and then it went away completely.
Okay. While I was doing some research for another article I was writing, I ran across a paper that was done by a fellow named Roger Roots. The article is, Are Cops Constitutional? And it kind of intrigued me, so I read it, and I couldn't put it down. It supported everything that I've felt. But he had done the research that I hadn't done regarding the subject on whether cops were constitutional or not. His name is Roger Root, and his background is he's a doctor of jurisprudence, a master's of jurisprudence. He graduated from Roger Williams University of Law and Roger Williams University School of Justice Studies and Montana State University in Billings, Montana. He is a former federal prisoner and founder of Prison Crisis Project, so he has sat on both sides of the justice system. Now, it's a very detailed paper, and I'm going to be going through it, pointing out what he has written, and some places there are footnotes that accentuate what he said. But the whole question that has been in my mind for a long time is, since police departments didn't exist in 1787-89, they didn't exist in this country until much later, are they constitutional, or do they constitute what Boston was realizing when Thomas Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence about a standing army. Now, a standing army is people with rifles who have are there to keep people from doing things, control them. That's a standing army. It's not having an army in a cat. We've had a standing army in the term that we've been led to believe is a standing army for a long time. From the beginning of the Constitution, we maintain army base or army forts on the peripheral in the frontier areas where Indians were still a threat. Through the entire expansion of the country, we've had cavalry posts all over. They've always had soldiers stationed at certain forts. The whole idea of a standing army has been misrepresented lately to think that we mean, well, like the soldiers we've got at Fort Polk and all these military bases. And that is not the concept of standing army, because police departments didn't exist. It was the guys in the street that had guns and could shoot you, force you to do things. Now, a big difference between then and now, too, and I refer you to the Boston Massacre, where the soldiers stood trial for shooting civilians because they did not have permission from the governor of the state, the civil authority, to use their weapons against people. They stood trial. Two were convicted of manslaughter and sought sanctity of the church, which saved their lives, and then they were branded on the thumb and went back in the army. That's a standing army. Now, what we have today is cops can shoot you just because they think they have a right to shoot you, and the courts have upheld them. And that's what we're going to be talking about. So whether you object to the term cop, which was, you know, canine control officers, dog collectors, I forgot what they called them now. Dog catchers, yeah. You can't soften the effect of what damage something does to a society by softening the name. A queer is a queer. It's not a gay person. It's a queer. A cop is a standing army. He's not an LEO. You can call him an LEO if it makes you feel better. But you have to understand the concept of freedom and liberty that the founding fathers have. And I've addressed it on the fringes in a number of articles. John Bad Elk is a good example, the right to self-defense. Ashwander versus TVA is another example, because that's how we got to where we are now. So here we go. Uniformed police officers are the most visible element of America's criminal justice system. Their numbers have exponentially grown over the past century and now stand at hundreds of thousands nationwide. This was written in 1995. That number is about a million right now. Police expenses count for the largest segment of most municipal budgets and generally dwarf expenses for fire, trash, and sewer services. Now, he's got a footnote in here that's rather interesting, because it says that Los Angeles, California, 49.1, this is 95, 49.1% of its annual discretionary budget is police. 17.7% on fire, 14.8% on public works. That's maintaining the roads. You wonder why you have bad roads? Because the cops get the money. In every state, in every city, in every town, everywhere there are police departments, they get a lion's share of the government funding, and they get federal funding in most cases, which gives them strings to the federal the Justice Department, and obliges them considerably to it. And if I can find it, I'll post an article I wrote on that subject. The 1994 Crime Control Act gave money for cops on the street. And it also explained that they were going to teach them how to get people to forfeit their assets, violation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, to offset the increased cost of additional policemen. So, back to the article. Yet the dissident English colonists, neither casual observers nor learned authorities regard the sight of hundreds of armed uniformed state agents on Americans' roads and street corners as anything peculiar. let alone invalid or unconstitutional. Now, understand that we were all brought up believing police is a man's best friend. Well, that was before the end of World War II, police were there to help us. That's when they had to protect and serve on their cars, which they still do in L.A. But we're abused by them on a regular basis nowadays. But we've accepted that. That's been our life. We have no concept, unless we look into history, of what the founders perceived as the right to freedom and liberty. The dissident English colonists who framed the United States Constitution would have seen this modern police state as alien to their foremost principles. Under the criminal justice model known to the framers, professional police officers were unknown. The general public had broad law enforcement powers, and only the executive function of the law, the execution of writs, warrants, and orders, were performed by constables or sheriffs, who might call upon members of the community for assistance. Initiation and investigation of criminal cases was nearly exclusive province of private citizens. At the time of the Constitution's ratification, the office of the sheriff was in an appointed position, and constables were either elected or drafted from the community to serve without pay. Now, in most cases, though, they could receive pay if they got a reward, they could charge people to fill out paperwork, things like that, so they weren't completely without pay. Most of their duties involved civil executions rather than criminal law enforcement. The courts of that period were venues for private litigation, whether civil or criminal, and the state was rarely a party. Professional police, as we know them today, originated in American cities during the second quarter of the 19th century. And that's prior to the Civil War, when municipal governments drafted citizens to maintain order. The role of these nightly watch officers gradually grew to encompass the catching of criminals, which had formerly been the responsibility of individual citizens. This modern police-driven model of law enforcement helps sustain a playing field that is fundamentally uneven for different players upon it. Modern police act as an army of assistance for state prosecutors and gather evidence solely with an eye towards the interests of state's interest. Police seal off crime scenes from the purview of defense investigators, act as witnesses of convenience for the state in courts of law, and instigate a substantial amount of criminal activity under the guise of crime fighting. Additionally, police enforce social class norms and act as tools of the empowerment for favored interests to the disadvantage of others. Police are also a political force that constantly lobby for increased state power and decreased constitutional liberty for American citizens. The Constitution contains no explicit provision for criminal law enforcement. Read your constitutions if you have any doubt. Nor did the Constitution of any of the several states contain such provisions at the time of the founding. Early constitutions enunciated the intention of law enforcement was a universal duty that each person owed to the community rather than the power of the government. Founding era constitutions addressed law enforcement from the standpoint of individual liberties and placed explicit barriers on the state. So, the whole idea of posse comitatus, or the right of us to form a posse, was to arrest these people. If somebody got a warrant sworn out, the requirement for a warrant we'll go into later, got a warrant sworn out because somebody committed a crime, then he could gather, or the sheriff could assist him in gathering people together to go and arrest this person. There was no government entity that was charged with arresting people. For decades, before and after the Revolution, the adjudication of criminals in America was governed primarily by the rule of private prosecution. One, victims of serious crimes approach a community grand jury. Two, the grand jury investigates the matter and issues an indictment only if it concluded that a crime should be charged. 3. The victim himself or his representative, generally an attorney but sometimes the state attorney general, prosecute the defendant before a petite jury of 12 men. That was the process. Criminal actions were only a step away from civil actions, the only material difference being that criminal claims ostensibly involved an interest of the public at large as well as the victim. Private prosecutors acted under authority of the people and in the name of the state, but for their own vindication. The very term prosecutor means criminal plaintiff and implied a private person. A government prosecutor was referred to as an attorney general and was a rare phenomenon in criminal cases at the time of the nation's founding. When a private individual prosecuted an action in the name of the state, the attorney general was required to allow the prosecutor to use his name, even if the attorney general himself did not approve the action. Now, back up just a little bit. Here's what some of the addresses crime. To provide for the punishment of counterfeiting of the securities and current coin of the United States. To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. To make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces. To exercise exclusive legislative jurisdiction in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia and federal reservations. And then treason against the United States. Those were the only crimes recognized by our Constitution. The various states, pretty much with their original Constitution, supported the concept that I've just read to you. Now, criminal and civil matters, if it's an act of violence... What?
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Criminal actions tended to be actions where there was injury or damage to property, where that type of attitude, activity would tend to have an effect on the entire community, where civil was breach of contract or an agreement between parties. Law enforcement was a universal duty. Law enforcement in the founders' time was the duty of every citizen. Citizens were expected to be armed and equipped to chase suspects on foot, on horse, or with wagon whenever summoned. And when called upon to enforce the law of the state, citizens were to respond not faintly with lagging steps, but honestly and bravely and with whatever implement and facilities were convenient at hand. Any person could act in the capacity of a constable without being one, and when summoned by a law enforcement officer, a private person became a temporary member of the police department. They also presumed that any person acting in his public capacity as an officer was rightfully appointed. Okay, now are we getting a different picture than what we see now, that there weren't cops running around saying, prosecuting things? I'm going to give you an example. Back in about 1969, I lived in a place called Calabasas, California. And our house got broken into. They took the television, the stereo, and some other things. And I called the police. The police came out, filled out a report. And I said, well, look, there's fingerprints right there and there and there. Well, we don't lift fingerprints. You know, we don't deal with something like this. Later on, a few years later, I was in New York, and my Volkswagen bus was parked on a main street, and it was broken into. A broken Boy Scout knife was lying inside the Volkswagen bus. My jacket and some other things that were inside the bus were taken. He broke the wind wing. There was a bloody fingerprint. The cops came. I asked him if they're going to take a fingerprint. He said, Lindsay was mayor then, and he said if the mayor's son had been stabbed, the body was still warm and the knife was still in the body, we might take fingerprints. What we do is write reports for your insurance company. Now, I'm not sure what law enforcement is supposed to imply, but if theft is a violation of the law, we've gone full circle. We have a standing army, but we don't have anybody enforcing the law, and the law doesn't allow me to enforce it anymore. So we've lost enforcement of law, and we call people law enforcement officers that could care less their job is not to do that, is to raise revenues by giving tickets on roadsides, hassle us. If you don't believe we live in a police state, next time you're driving down the road and you see a car behind you that's black and white in most states, they're getting very colorful now, but it has that bubblegum light on top of it, what's your first reaction? You look at your speedometer, you hope your lights are working, you get nervous. Why is that? Oh, we don't live in a police state. We just fear the hell out of those people in uniform. And I realize there are some on the chat tonight that probably aren't liking very much what I'm saying, but that's the reality when we compare it to the Constitution. Going on, police as social workers. Few of the duties of founding area sheriffs involved criminal law enforcement. Instead, civil execution, attachments, and confinements dominated their work. They were an administrator for the county. When professional police units first arrived on the American scene, they functioned primarily as protectors of public safety, health, and welfare. This role followed the Bobby model developed in England in the 1830s by the father of professional policing, Sir Robert Peel, which is where the name Bobby came from. Early police agencies provided a vast array of municipal services, including keeping traffic thoroughfares clear. Boston police made 30,681 arrests during one fiscal year in 1880, but in the same year reported 1,472 accidents, secured 2,461 buildings found open, reported thousands of dangerous and defective streets, sidewalks, chimneys, drains, sewers, and hydrants, tended to 169 corpses. No, tended to the corpses. That means they picked them up off the street and took them down to the morgue. They didn't go out start trying to find who killed them. Assisted 148 intoxicated persons, located 1,572 lost children, reported 228 missing but only 151 found persons, rescued 7 persons from drowning, assisted nearly 2,000 sick, injured, and insane persons, and found 311 stray horse teams and removed more than 50,000 street obstructions. Well, that was 1880 in Boston. They're removing street obstructions. They're finding lost horses. They're helping sick, injured, and insane people. They don't shoot insane people like they do now. They help them. They assisted 148 intoxicated persons. They don't throw them in jail unless they don't have a place to sleep. They'd help them home. They were looking out for the safety of the people, not for the raising of revenues and all this other crap they do now. But the Constitution of the founding era gave no hint of any thin blue line. Nothing in their text enunciated any governmental power to fight crime at all. Crime fighting was intended as the domain of individuals touched by crime. The original design under the American Legal Order was to restore a semblance of private justice. The courts were a mere forum and or avenue for private persons to attain justice from a malfeasor. The slow alteration of the criminal courts into a venue only for government's claims against private persons turned the very spirit of the founders' model on its head. Now remember what I told you. They would not look for my television. They would not look for who broke into my Volkswagen and stole my property. They do it if it's in the best interest of the government only. They could care less about us. To suggest that modern policing is extra-constitutional is not to imply that every aspect of police work is constitutionally improper. Rather, it is to say that the totality and effect of modern policing negates the meaning and purpose of certain constitutional protections the framers intended to protect and carry forward to future generations. Modern-style policing leaves many fundamental constitutional interests utterly unenforced. Now, I will say that it's either Washington or Oregon that if you get a flat tire on the side of the road, the state police up there are required to stop and help you. So sometimes some of the residue of the original concept of police serving and protecting does remain. Americans today, for example, are far more vulnerable to invasive searches and seizures by the state than were the Americans of 1791. The framers lived in an era in which much less of the world was in plain view of the government, and a stop and frisk would have been rare indeed. The totality of modern policing also places pedestrian and vehicle travel at the mercy of the state, a development the framers would have almost certainly never sanctioned. These infringements result not from a single aspect of modern policing, but from the whole modern policing's control over large domains of private life that were once policed by private citizens. The treatment of law enforcement in the court shows that the law of crime control has changed monumentally over the past two centuries. Under the common law, there was no difference whatsoever between the privileges and immunities and powers of constables and those of private citizens. Gee, I was as good as a constable or a sheriff back then. Constables were literally and figuratively clothed in the same garments as everyone else and faced the same liabilities, civil and criminal, as everyone else under identical circumstances. When was the last time you heard of a cop being charged for shooting somebody? Waco, Ruby Ridge. Two centuries of jurisprudence, however, have recast the power relationship of these two roles dramatically. Perhaps the first distinction between the rights of citizenry and constabulary came in the form of increased power to arrest. Early in the history of policing, courts held that an officer could arrest if he had reasonable belief both in the commission of a felony and the guilt of the arrestee. This represented a marginal yet important distinction from the right of a private person who could only arrest if a felony had actually been committed. It remains somewhat of a mystery, however, where this distinction was first drawn. Scrutiny of the distinction suggested it arose in England in 1827 for more than a generation after the ratification of the Bill of Rights. Moreover, the distinction was legitimate from its birth, being a bastardization of an earlier rule allowing constables to arrest upon transmission of reasonably reliable information from a third person. The earlier rule made perfect sense when many arrests were executed by private persons. Authority was a narrow defense available only to those who met the highest standard of accuracy. But when Americans began to delegate their law enforcement duties to professionals, the law relaxed to allow police to execute warrantless felony arrests upon information received from third parties. For obvious reasons, constables could not be required to be right all the time, so the rule of strict liability for false arrest was lost. Now, the constable could be held if he arrested the wrong person. The person had recourse. If you spent 10 days in jail, you could get whatever you got paid for those ten days, how much money you would have made, and could have gone after punitive damages to discourage him and to reward you for having suffered this loss of liberty. Think about that today. You go to jail, you give them money, they let you out. Last time I paid bail, they kept 5% of it as a handling charge. Bullshit. Moreover, the distinction was illegitimate from its birth, being a bastardization. Should have read that one, didn't I? Mm-hmm. The trade-off has had the effect of depriving Americans of certainty in the execution of warrantless arrests. Judges now consider only the question of whether there was reasonable grounds to suspect an arrestee rather than whether the arrestee was guilty of any crime. The loss of certainty, when combined with greater deference to the state in most law enforcement matters, has essentially reversed the original intent and purpose of American law enforcement, that the state act against stern limitations and at its own peril. Now, the state used to be held liable. They're not anymore, because arrest has become the near-exclusive province of professional police. Americans have fewer assurances that they are free from unreasonable arrests. Distinction between the privileges of citizens and police officers grow more rapidly in the 20th century. State and federal lawmakers enshrined police officers with expansive immunities from firearms laws, from the laws regulating the use of equipment such as radio scanners, body armor, and infrared scopes. Legislatures also exempted police from full road charges, granted police confidential telephone numbers and auto registration, and even exempted police from fireworks regulations. Police are also protected by other statutory immunities and protections, such as mandatory death sentences for defendants who murder them, reimbursement of moving expenses when officers receive threats to their lives, and even special protections from assailants infected with AIDS virus. Officers who legally eavesdrop, wiretrap, or intrude upon privacy are protected by a statutory, as well as case law, good faith defense, while private citizens who do so face up to 5 years in prison. The tendency of legislatures to equip police with ever-expanding rights, privileges, and powers has, if anything, been strengthened rather than limited by the courts. Now, think back. If I had to investigate the crime and decide who to charge if something happened, I should have the same authority at the police. That means the authority to wiretap, to do any number of things as long as they're consistent with state law. But there was a case called Olmstead, and Tim McVeigh referred to it in his allocution after sentencing. And Olmstead, Washington State, had a law against wiretapping. Some federal people went in and wiretapped some telephones. Based on the wiretap, charges were brought against these bookkeepers. They were charged in court, and they said that the law was, it was illegal to wiretap in Washington. The federal government, the federal court decided that the federal government had immunity from state law. Now, think about that. The police then have immunity from state law. Now, the first thought that comes to mind is, well, we've got to do that. We've got to catch these bad guys. Well, we'll get to that shortly. We'll get an idea of how many bad guys really get arrested and charged and convicted, as opposed to how many people are just singled out and because of the weight of government, their ability to have phenomenal amounts of resources at their disposal make it a very uneven playing field, to say the least. Nothing illustrates the modern disparity between rights and powers of police and citizens as much as the modern law of resisting arrest. At the time of the nation's founding, any citizen was privileged to resist arrest if, for example, probable cause for arrest did not exist, or the arresting person could not produce a valid arrest warrant when one was needed. As recently as 100 years ago, but with a tone that seems as if from some other more distant age, the United States Supreme Court held that it was permissible, at least defensible, to shoot an officer who displays a gun with the intent to commit a warrantless arrest based on insufficient cause. Now, that refers to John Bad Elk, one of my favorite cases. John Bad Elk was found guilty of murdering a police officer. The Supreme Court released him and said it would be a misdemeanor or no crime at all. He had every right to resist arrest absent a lawful warrant. Officers who executed an arrest without proper warrant were themselves considered trespassers, and any trespassee had a right to violently resist or even assault and batter an officer to evade such arrest. Well, in the 20th century, violent resistance was considered a lawful remedy for Fourth Amendment violations. Even third-party intermeddlers were privileged to forcibly liberate wrongly arrested persons from unlawful custody. The doctrine of non-resistance against unlawful government actions was harshly condemned at the Constitutional Conventions of the 1780s, and both Maryland and New Hampshire constitutions contain provisions denouncing non-resistance as absurd, slavish, and destructive good happiness of mankind. By the 1980s, however, many, if not most, states had eliminated the common law right of resistance, criminalized the resistance of any officer acting in his official capacity, eliminated the requirement that an arresting officer present his warrant at the scene, drastically decreased the number of types of arrests by which a warrant is required, Although some state courts have balked at this march towards efficiency in favor of the state, none require the level of protection known to the framers. Now, I've always said one of my favorite crimes is people charged with resisting arrest, and that's the only charge brought against them. That's an acknowledgement of the failure of the system and our right to resist an unlawful arrest. If the only charge against me is resisting arrest, what right did he have to arrest me? But the court will not ask that question. They will only confirm that I was charged with resisting arrest, I was proven guilty, and I shall be punished. Now, it hasn't happened to me yet, but it has happened to people I know. The only crime they were convicted of was resisting arrest. And they were given a few days in jail, and most of them were time served, but that was strictly to mediate the cop's role in violating the laws. You know, they had to find him guilty so he couldn't be charged with the false arrest. So there's kind of loopholes in the law. As long as I'm convicted of false arrest, then the cop is free. He can't be charged with false arrest. False arrest is denial of liberty. That's exactly what they said in the John Badal cases. So you're beginning to get a picture of how we've gone south in terms of justice. In 1985, the United States Supreme Court purported to... As a practical matter, the Garner case. Tennessee versus Garner involved police killing of an unarmed juvenile burglary suspect. Court limited police use of deadly force to cases of self-defense or defense of others. In 1985, the Supreme Court limited police use of deadly force to cases of self-defense or defense of others. What we're going to go into now is what this article refers to as testifying. All the cop has to do is say, "I feared for my life," and he's satisfied that what's called the Garner rule, the Supreme Court requirement that he act in self-defense. And cops shoot people all the time and claim that they feared for their lives and the person they killed was unarmed. So the courts kind of go along with this and say, well, he has had reasonable belief to think his life was threatened. Now, there were years ago, back in the 30s, the cop didn't shoot at anybody unless he was shot at or if he fired a warning shot first. Now, that's gone by the wayside. A guy named Diallo in New York gained a couple pounds in lead, and he was unarmed. As a practical matter, however, the Garner rule is much less stringent because federal civil rights actions inevitably turn not on strict constitutional rule, such as the Garner rule, but on the perception of a defendant officer. Officers enjoy a litigation advantage over all other parties. In no reported cases has a judge or jury held an officer liable who used deadly force where a mere reasonable belief that human life was in imminent danger existed. Cops never lie, right? Some lower courts have interpreted Garner to permit deadly force even where suspects pose no immediate and direct threat of death or serious injury to others. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently denied the criminal liability of an agent who shot and killed an innocent person to prevent another person from retreating to take up a defensive position. So it sounds like the cop shot the hostage before the bad guy got behind the hostage. Drawing criticism from Judge Kuczynski in that court, that the court had adopted a 007 standard for police shootings. That all the cop has to do is decide he wanted to pull his finger, and that becomes justification because they've obfuscated the intent and watered down the Constitution and all these concepts that existed in this country. Untold dozens, if not hundreds, of Americans have been shot in the back while fleeing police, even after the Garner decision. Police have shot and killed suspects who did nothing more than make a move, reach for their identification too quickly, reach into a jacket or pocket, make a motion of going for a gun, turn either toward or away from officers, pull away from an officer as an officer opened a car door, rub their eyes and stumble forward after a mace attack, or allegedly lunge with a knife, a hatchet, or a ballpoint pen. Cops, now those I just read all came from court cases, and the cops were not charged with a crime. Cops have been known to open fire on and kill persons who brandished or refused to drop virtually any handheld object, a Jack Daniel's whiskey bottle, a metal rod, a wooden stick, a kitchen knife, even while eating dinner, a screwdriver, a rake, or even refused an order to raise their hands. Cops were all vindicated in killing those people. Cops who shot an individual holding a shiny object that can be said to resemble a gun, such as a cash box, a shiny silver pen, a TV remote control, or even a can opener, are especially likely to avoid liability in line with this defense. Police officers nationwide have been caught planting weapons on their victims in order to make shootings look like self-defense. In one of the more egregious examples ever proven in court, Houston police were found during the 1980s to have utilized an unofficial policy of planting guns on victims of police violence. 75% to 80% of all Houston officers apparently carried throw-down weapons for such purposes. Only the dogged persistence of the aggrieved relatives and the first-hand testimony of intrepid witnesses unraveled the police cover-up of the policy. Now, you law enforcement people out there, I'm sure you don't know any cops that do this. I've got a saying about cops. There's no such thing as a good cop, because a good cop has an obligation to enforce the law. And if he turns his back on his fellow officers, he's not enforcing the law. So he must not be a good cop. He must be a bad cop.
You know, Gary, you're right. On a lot of these things that you said, all we need to do is look around at our society. Look around at what the police are doing. You know, when, you know, there was a... I mean, these instances are countless. I mean, we can go and just jump on YouTube, like somebody pointed out, and just pull up thousands of them. You know, but when three cops are standing over an individual who's handcuffed, face down on the ground, and they shoot him, and he gets shot twice in the back of the head and in his back, we have a problem when those cops are not charged. You know, when we see, you know, young cops tasering 70-year-old women to death, and their excuse was, I felt in fear for my safety. What the hell is that shit? When unarmed people who refuse to raise their hand, like one individual pointed out in Minnesota, I guess, you know, he refused to raise his arms, to put his arms up, had nothing on him, didn't have anything in his hands, just refused to comply, and they killed him as well. I mean, you know, all we have to do is look around and open our eyes and be honest with ourselves. This is not the way it should be.
No. Now, we've talked about some of the transitions that he's pointed out. I'm going to mention some that, putting the article down for a minute, I'm going to mention some that I've noticed. When I was a kid in the 50s, most of the cops that I met had just come back from World War II. They were MPs in Europe or Asia. What had happened during World War II, before that time, cops would buy a lost kid an ice cream and then help him find his parents. They were helpful people. Even when I was young, they were helpful people. Cops were nice guys. They were friendly. They were cheerful. They didn't talk down at you. They weren't arrogant assholes. That didn't exist. But then, during the war, a lot of cops that were going to retire, and they didn't mind being called cops, by the way, a lot of the cops that were going to retire during the war chose not to retire because all the young men were going overseas. So you get these MPs from Europe and Asia. They've just been dealing with drunken soldiers who have been killing people for a few years. The potential for violence was very great. But when they got out of the Army, they said, well, what job can I take? Well, I was a cop in the military, so I think I'll be a cop in the when I get back to the States. So we get these guys that are hardened to these guys that have survived war, brutal war. They've killed people. They've seen their buddies killed. When they get a chance to get drunk and release themselves from the environment they live in, they get shit-faced drunk, no telling what they're going to do. So the people that had to handle those guys come back and become the police force. They start taking jobs as police, allowing the older, should-have-been-retired police officers to retire and get their pensions and go back and kick their feet up and sit under the cherry tree. So we got a shift that was a transition from World War II that developed more of an arrogance, but still cops were nice people in the 50s and the 60s. But they just had a different attitude. It was more of a I'm important, you're not attitude, but it was still friendly, and it was still to serve and protect. When I was a kid, I and a lot of other people would get stopped for running a red light with a warning. If I was found drunk, they would give me a ride home. That still existed in the 50s and 60s in this country. However, Los Angeles Police Department started in something in 1967, and I used to have a copy of the SWAT training manual from 1967. It set the then or us mentality up, and that mentality you see on the chat if you look real close. What they did is they described who the potential criminal is. He could be an ex-convict, a disgruntled employee, an irritated neighbor. It went on, it listed five or six different things, and then it said, or even your neighbor. So they just, kind of like the MIAC and the DHS report says, all patriots are potential terrorists, they lumped everybody outside of the police department and the justice system into one category, from the ex-convict to even your neighbor. They included everybody in a big warm blanket and said, these all potentially are bad guys. Well, it's true, but when you start conditioning people in their head that all these people could be bad guys, you have begun creating what evolved out of 1967 is the them or us mentality. Now, does that mentality reality? When I was had my survey office in Winter Springs, Florida, I had a Jeep Wagoneer, and Winter Springs at the time had a lot of dirt roads, and so in rainy season, cops would get stuck all the time. If I saw or heard that a cop got stuck, I'd go over and pull him out with my Jeep. They were very grateful. You know, we even smoked stolen pot together, stolen pot. They'd find some 14-year-old kids with pot and say, give me the pot, you go tell your parents. We won't do anything legally about it. And then they'd go smoke the pot. They'd invite me over. So I got along with them very well, and I was one of them because I had become part of their group. Probably never as much as a guy with a badge, but I became part of their group, and I was respected by them. After 5 or 6 years of not seeing this one cop that I was pretty close to, I just happened to be talking to, I was driving down a street in Longwood, and I saw a motor cop that was a guy, I can't remember his name now, that I knew. So I stopped and I was talking with him. This lady came down the road, and it was a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit. She was going about 30 or 32 or something, and he was giving people tickets. I watched him give five or six tickets out, and then this lady came down the road, and he stopped her, and he was pulling his ticket book out, and I walked up and I said, hi, Barbara. She said, hi, Gary. He said, you know her? I said, yeah, we used to work together. Oh, he said, well, let me give you a warning. Keep it under 25 on this road. So the them or us mentality even went from me to somebody that I knew, at least in my presence. If he saw her the next day, he'd probably give her a ticket. But that's the them or us mentality. And it's not just a figment of my imagination, because I've seen it too many times. So let's go back to the article. There's a lot more in here that is going to astound you. And I got to get my cigarette lit first. excuse me. Police work, let's see, defenders of police violence often cite the dangerous nature of police work, claiming that the police occupation is filled with risks to life and health. Police training itself, especially elite SWAT type or paramilitary training that many officers crave reinforces the dangerousness of police work in the officers' own minds. There is some truth to this perception in that around 100 officers are feloniously killed in the line of duty each year in the United States. But police work's billing is as a dangerous profession plummets in credibility when viewed from a broader perspective. Homicide, after all, is the second leading cause of death on the job for all American workers. The taxi cab industry suffers homicide rates almost 6 times higher than the police and detective industry. A police officer's death on the job is almost as likely to be from an accident as from homicide. And he's got some quote here, 40% of police deaths are due to accidents. So 40% of police deaths are due to accidents. So if the 100 are homicides, that means there's almost half of that number is accidental. Not homicide, but an accident, them driving too fast or something. When overall rates of injury and death on the job are examined, policing barely ranks at all. The highest rates of fatal workplace injuries occur in the mining and construction industries, with transportation, manufacturing, and agriculture following closely behind. Fully 98% of all fatal workplace injuries occur in the civilian labor force. Moreover, police work is generously rewarded. The National Institute of Occupation, OSHA, fatal injuries to workers in the United States gave those figures I gave you. Moreover, police work is generously rewarded in terms of financial, pension, and other benefits, not to mention prestige. Police salaries may exceed $100,000 annually, plus generous health insurance and pension plans, placing police in the very highest percentile of American workers in terms of compensation. The founding generation would have been utterly astonished by such a transfer of wealth to professional law enforcers. This reality of police safety, security, and comfort is one of the best-kept secrets in American labor. See, their job is no more dangerous than anybody else's. Only 100 out of them, at the time, I think the number was 700,000. So that would be, say, 120 officer deaths out of 7 million. What percentage is that? That's about 1 in 10,000. That's really risky job if only 1 in 10,000 dies. Boy, that's life's tough. In all, it is questionable whether modern policing actually decreases the level of bloodshed on American streets. Police often bring mayhem, confusion, and violence wherever they are called. Some examples. When cops prevented relatives finding municipalities immune from liability, when cops are prevented relatives of injured shooting victims from taking victim to hospital before victim died. Tennessee police officer prevented firefighters from saving victims of fire in 1997. Another was the 1993 Waco fire in which fire trucks were held back by federal agents. The MOVE debacle in Philadelphia in which police dropped a bomb on a building occupied by women and children and then held back firefighters from rescuing burn victims. And investigative hearings revealed cops had held back a rescuer as a tactical decision. So police have stopped the saving of lives by doing certain things. On the that would have saved lives otherwise. Approximately one-third of the people killed in high-speed police car chases, which are often unnecessarily escalated by police, are innocent bystanders. Cops occasionally prevent rather than execute rescues. Police practices ranked as the number one cause of violent urban riots of the 1960s. Indeed, police activity participated in or even initiated some of the nation's worst riots. During the infamous Chicago police riot during the Democratic National Convention in 1968, police physically attacked 63 newsmen and indiscriminately beat and clubbed numerous innocent bystanders. Professionalism. If the modern model of cop-driven criminal justice has any defense at all, it is professionalism. Private law enforcement of the type intended by the framers was supposedly more inclined towards lax and arbitrary enforcement than professional officers who are sworn to uphold the law. Upon scrutiny, however, the claim that professional police are more reliable, less arbitrary, and more capable of objective law enforcement than private law enforcers is drastically undermined. The constitutional model of law enforcement, investigation by a citizen grand jury, arrest by private individuals, constables, or citizens, and private prosecution, becomes seen as inefficient and ineffective as America enters its industrial age. Yet the grand jury in its natural and unhobbled state is more, rather than less, able to pursue investigations when compared to professional police. Grand jurors are not constrained by Fourth or Fifth or Sixth Amendments, or at least the exclusionary rule fashioned by the courts to enforce those amendments. In the absence of police troops to enforce the law, the early criminal justice system was hardly as hobbled and impotent as conventional wisdom suggests. Private watch groups and broad-based advocacy groups existed to enforce laws and track criminals among jurisdictions. Thousands of local anti-horse thief associations and countless detecting societies sprang up to answer the call of crime victims in the 19th century. In Maine, the Penobscot Temperance League hired detectives to investigate and initiate criminal cases against illegal liquor traffickers. In the 1870s, a private group called the Society for the Suppression of Vice became so zealous in garnering prosecutions of the moral that it was accused in 1878 of coercing a defendant into mailing birth control information in violation of federal statutes. One of the earliest known instances of conduct that later became defined as entrapment. Although some of these private crime-fighting groups were invested with limited state law enforcement powers, they were not police officers in the modern sense and received no remuneration. Such volunteer non-professionals continue to aid law enforcement as auxiliary officers in many American communities. Additionally, private organizations affiliated with regional chambers of Congress, Neighborhood Watch, and other citizens groups continue to play a substantial, though underappreciated, role in crime fighting. Unfortunately, though, the government is very selective in who they allow in some of these. For example, if you want to get on Sheriff Joe Arpaio's posse, you have to make a substantial campaign contribution. You don't have to know how to shoot a gun, but you have to make a substantial campaign contribution. America has a long history of outright vigilante justice, although vigilantism has been exaggerated in both its sordidness and in its scope. Now, that came as a result, obviously, of failure of law enforcement, the sheriff, to do his job. In fact, we'll find out about a sheriff that got hung because of that. Moreover, government-operated policing is hardly a monopoly even today, neither in maintaining order nor over matters of expertise and intelligence gathering. There are three times more private security guards than public police officers, and even activities such as guarding government buildings, including police stations, and forensic analysis are now done by private security personnel. The chief selling point for professional policing seems to be the idea that sworn government agents are more competent crime solvers than grand juries, private prosecutors, and unpaid volunteers. But this claim disintegrates when the realities of police personnel are considered. In 1998, for example, 40% of the graduating recruits of the Washington, D.C. Police Academy failed the comprehensive exam required for employment on the force and were described as practically illiterate and borderline retarded. They got all the way through the academy, though. As a practical matter, police are more dependent upon the public than the public is dependent upon the police. Cops rely on the public for a very high percentage of their investigation clearances. As the rate of crimes committed by strangers increase, the rate of clearance by the police invariably declines. roughly two-thirds of major robbery and burglary arrests occur solely because a witness can identify the offender. The offender is caught at or near the crime scene, or the offender leaves evidence at the scene. In contrast, where a suspect cannot be identified in such ways, odds are high that the crime will go unsolved. Studies show that government policing has taken over criminal investigations. The rates of clearance for murder investigations have actually gone down for more than three decades. While police units have expanded greatly in size, power, and jurisdiction, the gap between the number of homicides in the United States and the number of cases solved has widened by almost 20%. Today, almost 3 in 10 homicides go unsolved. No, they're not really very good investigators, I guess. This goes into DNA and how many 5,000 suspects have been released as a consequence of DNA testing, where the police were sure they had their man. That's pretty drastic. I mean, every once in a while one hits the news where DNA gets some guy out of jail after 27 years in prison, and he's just glad to be out. Probably because his attorneys told him if he wanted to sue them for false imprisonment, he'd probably end up back in prison. Let's see. Even more unjustified is the notion that a justice system powered by professional police possesses higher levels of integrity, trustworthiness, and credibility than the criminal justice model intended by the framers. Within the criminal justice system, cops are regarded as little more than professional witnesses of convenience, if not professional perjurers for the prosecution. Almost no authority credits police with high levels of honesty. Indeed, the daily work of cop requires strategic lying as part of the job descriptions. Cops lie about the strength of their evidence in order to obtain confessions, about giving Miranda warnings to arrestees when on the witness stand, and even about substantive evidence when criminal cases need more support. Cops throughout the United States have been caught fabricating, planning, and manipulating evidence to obtain convictions where cases would otherwise be very weak. Some authorities regard police perjury as so rampant that it can be considered a subcultural norm rather than an individual aberration of police officers. Large-scale investigations of police units in virtually every major American city have documented massive evidence tampering, abuse of the arresting power, and discriminatory enforcement of laws according to race, ethnicity, gender, and socioeconomic status. Recent allegations in Los Angeles charged that dozens of officers abused their authority by opening fire on unarmed suspects, planting evidence, dealing illegal drugs, or framing some 200 innocent people. Those were all proven. More than 100 prosecutions had to be dismissed in Chicago in 1997 due to similar police misconduct. During the infamous French Connection case of 1970s, New York City narcotics detectives were caught diverting 188 pounds of heroin and 31 pounds of cocaine for their own use, making the city special investigation unit the largest heroin and cocaine dealer in the city. It was nice of him to remind us of all these things that we heard back in the past. Police criminality was so acute in New Orleans during the 1980s and 90s that people were afraid to report crimes for fear that corrupt officers would retaliate or tip off organized crime figures. One New Orleans officer was convicted of ordering the execution of a witness who reported him to the Internal Affairs Unit for allegedly pistol-whipping a teenager. 36 Washington, D.C. officers were indicted on charges such as drug dealing, sexual assault, murder, sodomy, and kidnapping in 1992. In Detroit, repeated corruption allegations have seen a number of low- and high-ranking officers go to prison for drug trafficking, hiring hitmen, providing drug protection, and looting informant funds. Police burglary rings have been uncovered in several cities. Think how easy that is. You make up a story. You're a cop. You make up a story. Say, I got the information from an informant. I need $500 to pay the informant. They give him the $500, and he goes and lies about what the informant, who doesn't exist, told him. Donald Scott in Malibu, California, was shot to death in his own home based on an informant saying there was marijuana growing on his property. He had a, I don't remember how many acres, a large, I think, 300-acre farm or parcel property above Malibu. And they flew over in an airplane. The agent said he flew over with the informant. The informant showed him where the marijuana was. He saw it, and then they got the warrant, made the raid. They were out of Los Angeles County, but they were from Los Angeles County. Donald Scott came out of his room wondering what was happening. He was in his underwear, had a gun in his hand. Based on the descriptions, he didn't point the gun at anybody, but he was shot dead right there. They didn't even find a marijuana seed on the 300 acres. There were no plants growing. There was no evidence of any cultivation of any sort going on in the property. But the informant told them it was there. They flew over it and saw it, and then it somehow mysteriously disappeared between him seeing it and the warrant, but I'm sure he got the informant's dollars for it. Even at the federal level, where national investigation, one thing he's missing in here, Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris were put on trial for their lives. If they were convicted, they could have been executed. A U.S. attorney and I think it was a U.S. Marshal, falsified some evidence. They were found out. They were fined $2,000. They probably make over $100,000 a year. They were fined $2,000 each. And they tried to murder Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris by falsifying evidence to get a conviction that would have sent them to the gas chamber. But we don't have any bad cops. Even at the federal level, where national investigators presume to police corruption and oversee local departments, favoritism towards the police role is rampant. In 1992, for example, the federal government filed criminal charges in only 27 cases of police criminality. A federal statute criminalizing the violations of the 14th Amendment has never been enforced even a single time, although it has been part of the U.S. Code since 1921. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, I wonder why they passed the law if nobody ever violated it. Throughout the 80s and 90s, the FBI crime laboratory abetted the misconduct of local police departments by misrepresenting forensic evidence to bolster police cases against defendants. In terms of pure economic returns, police are surprisingly poor public investment. Typical urban police work is very expensive because police see a primary part of the role as intervention for its own sake, poking, prodding, and questioning the public in hope of turning up evidence of wrongdoing. Towards this end, police spin quick U-turns, drive slowly and menacingly down alleyways, reverse direction to track suspected scofflaws, and conduct sidewalk pat-down searches of potential criminals absent clear indication of potential criminality. Studies indicate, however, that such tactics are essentially worthless in the war on crime. One experiment found that when police do not cruise but simply respond to dispatch calls, crime rates are completely unaffected. Thus, the very aspect of modern policing that the public views as most effective, the creation of a police presence, is in fact a monstrous waste of public resources. Similarly, the history of America's expenditures on the war on drugs provides little support for the proposition that money spent on policing yields positive returns. Now, here's some numbers on the federal drug control budget increased from $4.3 billion in 1988 to $11.9 billion in 1992, yet national drug supply increased greatly and prices dropped during the same period. The cost of enforcement in 1994 ranged from $79,376 per arrestee by the DEA to $260,000 per arrestee by the FBI, with no progress made at all towards decreasing the drug trade. Welcome to America. Can we afford that? K See, now we're getting to the part about police being a standing army. It is largely forgotten that the war for American independence was initiated in large part by the British Crown's practice of using troops to police civilians in Boston and other cities. Professional soldiers used in the same ways as modern police were among the primary grievances enunciated by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. He has kept among us standing armies. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power, protecting them by a mock trial. The duties of such troops are in no way military, but involve the keeping of order and the suppression of crime, especially customs and tax violations. So there are three elements of the Declaration of Independence that speak directly against police departments, the police state that we have today. Constitutional arguments quite similar to the thesis of this article were made by the American founders while fomenting the overthrow of their government. Thomas Jefferson proclaimed that although Parliament was supreme in its jurisdiction to make laws, His Majesty has no right to land a single armed man on our shores to enforce unpopular laws. James Warren said that the troops in Boston were there as an unconstitutional mission because their role was not military, but rather to enforce obedience to acts which, upon fair examination, appeared to be unjust and unconstitutional. Colonial pamphleteer Nicholas Ray charged that Americans did not have an enemy worth notice within 3,000 miles of them. The troops of George III have crossed the wide Atlantic not to engage an enemy, charged John Hancock, but to assist constitutional traitors in trampling on the rights and liberties of the king's most loyal subjects. Sound familiar? Does that apply today? Okay, Dave or Randy, give me a break.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, you're spot on with all of this. This is definitely been a big problem that's been growing in our society today, and it's very clear from history that it was never like this, and it was never intended to be like this, and this is something that we've got to find a way to address in a rational, sensical fashion and get this under control, because we have become a police state. It's obvious. You know, they're going around and just killing with impunity, and nothing happens to them. And there's something very wrong with this, just on a common sense level.
Yeah, it's gotten way out of hand. The problem is, like I said at the beginning, we were raised believing the police were good. And I'm older than probably most of the listeners, so I remember when cops were good guys. They would buy you an ice cream cone if you were standing on the street, a small kid standing on the street and crying. They would overlook you driving through a stop sign. They would take you home if you were drunk. All those things happened back then. But that was in that period between World War II. Now, these were the guys that had come back from Europe. But they began to create that hardening of the police. But it wasn't until the SWAT team and the Demarest mentality that it really took off. And as we look at the dates that I'm not reading all of this, but if we look at the dates on here, it was in the 60s and the 70s where the big transition to what we have today, the court cases and everything else, have been turned over. Now, how can it be that the Supreme Court said that you can shoot a cop if he doesn't have a warrant and is not making a lawful arrest, but now the cop can shoot you for not putting your hands up, and he's not responsible at all? It's been so converted back, turned upside down, that it's appalling when you think about it. Now,
it is.
There's the link for the article. If anybody wants to take and read the whole thing, it will be insightful. You will not ever think the same again after you've read the entire article. I'm just skimming through, getting some of the meat out of it. But it goes on, and every bit of it's legitimate.
Absolutely, and it is a must read. You really need to check this out. I'm not anywhere near as old as you are, but I still remember back in the day that the cops were a whole lot more friendly. We're lucky we're at here. The people we have in our sheriff's office are still pretty good folks that are actually out to help people. You know, when they pull you over, they're not all, you know, chomping at the bit to give you a ticket. They just want to be sure you're okay. You know, I've seen them in the field acting quite responsibly and in the best interest of the people. The city cops, you know, however, are not so much like that. We've got a lot of corruption here, and we got a bunch of young thugs with a chip on their shoulder that really enjoy this power trip. And what we need is peace officers, not police officers.
Well, that's what exactly it. We need to go back to peace officers, and those were the constables and the sheriffs. And I hope some that have espoused the role of the sheriff have recognized from this that it's not quite, wasn't at the founding, wasn't quite what a lot of people think it was. I think it was during the expansion of the West where the sheriff had more integrity than some of the police who were more political appointees or elected. The sheriff had more integrity and had more authority in the county. But that was not the founding concept. But the sheriff then had a couple of deputies. He didn't go around telling you to slow your carriage down or anything like that. He didn't fill the role of the modern police. He didn't go investigate. He didn't burst into your home without a warrant. He didn't do any of those things. The whole reason John Battle got off is because nobody broke in. Back to when I was a kid. Every once in a while, a newspaper would say that there was an arrest was made with a no-knock warrant. They called them no-knock warrants. They were only issued under certain circumstances where there was very good reason to believe that there was, say, a threat involved in the house. Say some guy was selling machine guns. That would justify it. So the standard of that has become nothing. On a bench warrant, they kicked down the door to my office and came in with their guns drawn to arrest me on a bench warrant for traffic violation. The world has gone south, and we've been left behind. The whole idea of any responsibility or accountability on the part of law enforcement, or for that matter, the entire judicial system, that includes the courts, because they're culpable in this whole thing, too. They're the ones that keep changing the laws and allowing them to change to protect the police who protect them. It's a brotherhood, and it includes the judges, the bailiffs, the clerks, the cops, even the meter maids. Everybody's in that package all together. It's one clique that protects itself against anything. And we're on the outside, and we can be shot and killed. Now, shot and killed, the whole reason, the concept and the reason for the John Badock decision is very simple. Freedom wasn't what they were seeking in this country. You'll see liberty far more often than freedom. But freedom and liberty were the goals. Now, liberty is the right to walk around unoffended. Freedom is a less direct attack on you. James Otis spoke against the writs of assistance, which were blanket warrants without specifics on them. And that was one of the causes. James Otis, until he got hit over the head and went funny, was probably one of the best spokesmen towards revolution early on, long before the revolution. I think he was dead before it started. I'm not sure. But this whole concept, the most important thing we have, by far, there's no question. If you have 1,000 things that are important to you, there's only one of any real significance, and that is your life. And if you don't have the right to defend your life against cops, you have nothing. There's nothing left. And now the courts and the police have taken that right to life away, and there's no challenge to it. Michael Hill was shot and killed. I will say he was murdered by some cops and sheriffs in Frazeesburg, Ohio. I went and investigated that. When I was done, I found out who the FBI investigator was for the charge of a civil rights violation, and I sent him my report. And the investigating sheriff for Muskegon County, who I worked with, you know, he led me in the evidence room. We talked quite a bit. I went over what I'd found with him. For example, Mike Hill's gun 45 caliber had been shot, hit by a bullet. The bullet came from the rear. The cop said Mike was shooting the, aiming the gun at the cop, and the cop shot and must have hit the gun because it flew out of Mike's hand. Well, if it flew out of Mike's hand, it fell about 4 inches from, based on the crime scene sketches, fell about 4 inches from his hand. But you think it was shot out of his hand, and it splayed out after it hit the gun, it splayed out and hit his hand. But when you look at the end of the gun, it was not shot straight on. There's a picture of it on my site. If you look up the murder of Mike Hill and go read my report, and I sent this to the FBI and asked them to respond, they never got back with me. They didn't want to deal with it, so they're involved in the cover-up of the murder of Mike Hill. But it could not possibly have happened the way the official report said that it happened. There's no way. And when things don't fit that way, you got to wonder. And when the police can't figure out that it doesn't fit that way, you really got to wonder, what do they really care about? They want to save this cop's ass because he murdered Mike Hill. Oh, anyway, back to the use of soldiers to enforce law had a long and sordid history in England, and by the mid-1700s were considered a violation of the fundamental rights of Englishmen. The Crown's response to London's Gordon riots of 1780, roughly contemporary to the cultural backdrop of the American Revolution, brought on an immense popular backlash at the use of guards to maintain public order. Deep, uncompromising opposition to the maintenance of a semi-much military professional force in civilian life remained integral to Anglo-Saxon legal culture for another century. Now, what happens at these demonstrations? The one up in Pittsburgh a couple of years ago, the ones in the 60s over the anti-war group.
The G20 you're talking about, no, in Pittsburgh, yeah. Right.
Right. The police come in force. They have batons. They have helmets. They have vests on. They have guns. They might have rubber bullets. What a concession, you know. It probably won't kill you if it's rubber, but a lot of people have died with a rubber bullet. They are a police force, and they're controlling our activities. Now, in a proper setting, they might be out there mingling with the crowd, and if they see somebody break a window and steal some furniture or a television out of a store, to grab that guy rather than punish the whole group that is there expressing speech. But their presumption that there's a few bad guys here, that guilt by association makes everybody then culpable, and so the police are treating everybody with total disrespect. Well, they work for us, and they treat us like shit. We've got a problem in this country. Now, perhaps a small-town cop is different. I've met some that I would say, well, I knew a guy in Florida that had been in Tennessee in a fairly small town. He went through the police academy, got on the police force. They had stopped this guy who talked back to one of the cops. And so all of them took turns beating him with a flashlight, except this guy that I knew. He wasn't fired, but he realized that he had to quit the police force because he refused to beat the guy with a flashlight for resisting arrest. So he quit the police force and went into a printing business. He was a good cop. But to be a good cop, he couldn't stay in the police department because he would have to arrest these cops, because they're violating the law. So there are good cops, but most of them leave. They can't stay, because if they do, then they become bad cops just by their failure to enforce the law. But the them or us mentality is always there. If it's between, if you know a cop in your town, and say some federal cop comes in, and you and the federal cop go at it over something, that cop is going to, the local cop is probably going to believe the federal cop because of the brotherhood. And that's what, I suggest to everybody that thinks they know and can trust their cops, don't let them know anything that they shouldn't know, that you wouldn't want everybody to know, because they might put it in a report. They might be acting like good guys. They might just feel that it's their job to put it in a report. But the worst part is if you rely on them, and that reliance isn't there when you need it, it may cost you your life. So be skeptical until they prove themselves, and they won't prove themselves until after April 19th, 1775, when the game is on, and it's going to be on until it's over. At that point, maybe you can begin to trust him if he still demonstrates a desire to be on your side. But you risk a lot by relying on something that you hope, you believe will be true. Englishmen of the founding era, both in England and in his colonies, regarded professional police as an alien continental device for maintaining a tyrannical form of government. That's interesting. It was a continental. That means Germany, France, Italy. A device for maintaining a tyrannical form of government. Boy, that bites deep, doesn't it? I think they were right.
Oh, yeah, it does.
Professor John Philip Rees has pointed out that few of the rights of Englishmen were better known to the general public than the right to be free of standing armies. Standing armies, according to one New Hampshire correspondent, have ever proved destructive to the liberties of a people, and where they are suffered, neither life nor property are secure. Now, standing armies, let's go back to what I said earlier. We've always had the cavalry out on the frontiers. We've always had garrisons on the frontiers to protect against Indian attacks. We've always had an army for defense, a relatively small one that could be added to with militia. But we've always had an army, and that's not the concept they have. It's when that army is brought into our own communities that it becomes a standing army. That's the point, that it's standing. Not the fact that it exists, but the fact that it's come into our communities, and from some of these that I've read already, you can understand that their concern was that when they are brought in that fact, they are enforcing social or tyrannical dictates. If pressed, modern police defenders would have difficulty demonstrating a single material difference between the standing armies the founders saw as so abhorrent and America's modern police force. Indeed, even the distinction between modern police and actual military troops have been blurred in the wake of America's modern crime war. 90% of American cities now have active special weapons and tactics teams, using such commando-style forces to do high-risk warrant work and even routine police duties. Such units are often instructed by active and retired United States military personnel. Now, military personnel are taught to kill, and these SWAT people walking with their gun sights, safety off and everything, are there to kill somebody. That's their purpose. They're looking for an opportunity to squeeze that trigger. There's no doubt about it. Even in Vietnam, we didn't carry our rifles up like that unless we knew that there was something threatening us. And with an M14, you don't hold it up like that very long. In Fresno, California, a SWAT unit equipped with battering rams, chemical agents, fully automatic submachine guns, and flashbang grenades roams full-time on routine patrol. Sounds like a waste of money. According to criminologist Peter Kraska, such military policing has never been seen on such a scale in American history, not even in Boston, where SWAT teams routinely break through a door, subdue all occupants, and search the premises for drugs, cash, and weapons. In high crime or problem areas, police paramilitary units may militarily engage an entire neighborhood, stopping anything that moves or surrounding suspicious homes with machine guns openly displayed. Much of the importance of the standing army debates at the ratification conventions has been overlooked or misrepresented by modern scholars. Opponents of the right to bear arms, for example, have occasionally cited the standing army debates to support the proposition the framers intended the Second Amendment to protect the power of states to form militias. Although this argument has been greatly discredited, it has helped eliminate the intense distrust that the framers manifested toward occupational standing armies. The standing army the framers most feared was the soldierly conducting law enforcement operations in the manner of King George's occupation troops, like the armies of police officers now patrol the American landscape. Now, the Second Amendment, the actual intent of the Second Amendment, that it protected a right of people to maintain the means of violently checking the power of government, has been all but lost in modern American society. Modern policing's increasing monopoly on firepower tends to undermine the framers' intent that the whole people be armed, equipped, and empowered to resist the state. Many police organizations lobby incessantly for gun control, even though the criminological literature yields scant empirical support for general gun control as a crime prevention measure. Nor is there much legitimacy to the claim that professional police are more accurate or responsible with firearms than the armed citizenry intended by the framers. To this day, civilians shoot and kill at least twice as many criminals as police do every year, and their error rate is several times lower. In a government study of handgun battles that led to officer injuries, it was found that police who fired upon their killers were less than half as accurate as their civilian, non-professional assailants. Now, the statistics on that. 41% accuracy by police as opposed to 91% accuracy by their assailants with handguns. So when there's a gunfight, the police are 41% accurate, and the assailant, the bad guy, is 91% accurate. The guys are well-trained, aren't they? Moreover, police seem hardly less likely to misuse firearms than the general public. In New York City, where private possession of handguns has been virtually eliminated for most civilians, problems with off-duty police misusing firearms has repeatedly surfaced. Los Angeles police have been found to fire their weapons inappropriately in 75% of the cases, and that was out of 700 cases. 75%.
Damn, that's alarming.
Almost 600 were inappropriate. No convictions, though. Between early inappropriate, just a slap your hand statement. Between early 1989 and late 1992, more than one out of every seven shots fired by Washington, D.C. police officers was fired accidentally. Well, I guess they don't know what safeties are. The Third Amendment, although the standing armies were not specifically barred by the final version of the Constitution's text, some authorities have pointed to the Third Amendment as likely font for such a conceptual proposition. Additionally, the amendments, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Now, they say quartered in the house because the standing army that they're talking about is a garrison. And when they came to Boston, there was no housing, so they were quartered. So he's talking about quartering them in the houses, putting them in the neighborhoods, in our midst, where nowadays they get paid over $100,000 a year in some cases. They have no problem buying their own home and living in our midst. But the concept that was in mind at the time did not anticipate that people would travel and come together in these large police forces and then spread back out and quarter themselves in our neighborhoods. The whole idea, the concept, was beyond them to think that that absent a place to stay, that you would bring the outsiders in. But they've made the cops, the outsiders, by the them or us mentality, psychologically, but physically, they're not outsiders because they live in the same communities that we do. The police state known by modern Americans would have been would be seen as quite tyrannical to the founders who ratified the Constitution. If Justice Brandeis suggested, the right to be left alone is the most important underlying principle of the Constitution. The cop-driven model of criminal justice is anthematic to American constitutional principles. Today, a vast and omnipotent army of insurgent patrols the American landscape in place of grand juries, private prosecutors, and occasional constable. This immense soldierly is forever at the beck and call of whatever social forces rule the day or even the afternoon. Now, some footnotes here. Saying the right to be left alone is the most comprehensive of rights and the right most valued by civilized men was what Brandeis said. Another footnote, a study done by in Criminology Magazine, finding officers are likely to use their power to control citizens at mere request of other citizens. And that's when your neighbor says, hey, that guy displayed a gun. The cop pulls his gun and points it at you and reaches in your pocket and he shoots you and then he reaches in your pocket and pulls out a TV clicker. That's the type of thing that... When the cop gets to the scene, whoever he wants to believe is the good guy, and the guy he doesn't want to believe is the bad guy. He makes a rational decision that should be made, an irrational decision that should be made rationally in a court of law, and he draws his gun on the bad guy. Quite often draws his gun on the bad guy if there's a potential or perceived potential for violence. So they become tools, manipulators of our society. We have come to fear them. I mean... I learned
judge, jury, and executioner.
When I get pulled over by a cop, the first thing I do is, like a puppy dog, drape my paws out, roll the window down, and drape my paws out there. Too many people have been shot. A cop had an excuse, and if my hands are on the hanging out the window, I don't give him any excuse unless he realizes I have a third hand. The amendment reads, the rights of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. This protection was clearly regarded as one of the more important provisions of the Bill of Rights during the debates in and out of Congress prior to the ratification. To this day, the amendment is probably the most cited constitutional provision in challenges to police actions. The footnote on that says, stating that an amendment protecting people from unreasonable searches and seizures was considered indispensable by many who opposed the Constitution. So that being in there satisfied a lot of people, and it was then addressed to the... People of Maryland in the Maryland Gazette talking about the origin of the Second Amendment, which was addressing the Fourth Amendment. This type of, let's see, more than one U.S. Supreme Court Justice and one state high court and various legal commentators, You got notes on what to read and not what to, what not to read, and I didn't make it very clear.
Oh, it's a very big topic, and it's a very big mess. The evisceration of the Fourth Amendment is absolutely unacceptable, and it's been getting progressively worse. You know, the Patriot Act and all these other unconstitutional laws that they've passed for, we'll just, take whatever we want. We'll come in. We don't need any warrants anymore. Stinking warrant now. We don't need that. No, it's absolutely ridiculous and it's unacceptable. And if we don't take a stand, it's going to continue to get worse. You know, we've seen a trend of this very, very clearly over the last 10 years. And it's been accelerating at a breakneck pace. You know, we have turned into a police state.
The older you are, the more you've seen the loss of these freedoms.
Absolutely.
When cops were nice guys. And that's getting harder and harder to find.
Absolutely it is.
This is dealing with warrants now. Under founding era common law, warrants were often considered as much a constitutional floor as a ceiling. Warrants did provide a defense for constables in most trespass suits, but were not good enough to immunize officials from liability for some unreasonable searches or seizures. Most often cited English case known to the framers who drafted the Fourth Amendment involved English constabulary who had acted pursuant to a search warrant but were nonetheless found civilly liable for stiff, punitive, and actual damages. So if the warrant is invalid, even the English constabulary could be held accountable for the invalidity of the warrant, which means that they had to make sure that they were on safe ground before they would issue a warrant, even if they weren't serving the warrant. For more than 150 years, it was considered per se unconstitutional for law enforcement to search and seize certain categories of objects, such as personal diaries or private papers, even with perfectly valid warrants. And the footnote on that is Boyd versus United States. Boyd's proposition was slowly watered down and distinguished in the case of Anderson versus Maryland. Let's see, holding that the business documents evidencing fraud, real estate dealings could be constantly seized by warrant. So here you had a crime that deals with real estate proceedings where they first broke that private papers issue. Before then, before that Boyd case, there was no possibility of their taking your private papers, your computer, your hard drive, your iPod, whatever they want to take now, which is what they take now.
They just take everything. It doesn't matter. They just grab it all.
They do.
It's ridiculous.
I don't know how many friends. Joe Valancourt still has not got his computer back. It was taken on February 26, 1993, 2 days before Waco. Derek Schout's computers were taken in 1994, and as far as I know, he has never gotten them back. Joe would not release the security, the password, and apparently he had a good encryption on it because, to my knowledge, they've never gotten into his computer, but he never got it back. And specificity, they'd have to say, I suppose if they said, you have a file on your computer that's an article that you wrote, and here's the title of the article, that's specific. Then they could take that file only. But anything else is phishing. And phishing
yep.
is what the warrant's for.
Exactly. And it used to be, back in the day, that things like that would get things thrown right smack dab out of court.
Yeah,
for having your rights violated. Not anymore.
Well, let's see. That Boyd case was 1886. That's when they first breached it. Additionally, Fourth Amendment jurisprudence prohibited the government from seizing as evidence any personal property which was not directly involved in crime, even with a valid warrant. So if somebody was shot by a shotgun and you had a .38 caliber pistol, they could not take the pistol. Unless it shoots shotgun pellets. The rationale for this mere evidence rule was that the interests of property owners were superior to those of the state and could not be overridden by mere indirect evidentiary justification. This rule, like many other obstacles to police search and seizure power, was discarded in the second half of the 20th century by a Supreme Court much less respectful of property rights than its predecessors. And that was 1967 in a Warden versus Hayden case. Holding the police can obtain even indirect evidence by use of search warrants. Hayden overturned all or at least five previous Supreme Court decisions by declaring that privacy rather than property was the principal object of the Fourth Amendment. So, the Constitution is a fluid document in the eyes of the Supreme Court because you got five decisions that say no, and then you get a bunch of yahoos come along and say yes. You can do it. The cops can do it. They can go fishing. If we were still back at the Constitution as intended by the framers, we wouldn't have this problem, would we?
Not at all.
Let's see. Under the founder's model, a private person like Josiah Butler, who lost 20 pounds of good pork under suspicious circumstances in 1787, could approach a justice of the peace and obtain a warrant to search the property of the suspected thief for the lost meat. which was a case. Private individuals applied for many or most of the warrants in the founders' era and even conducted many of the arrests. Even where sworn constables executed warrants, private persons often assisted them. To avoid liability, however, searchers needed to secure a warrant before acting. False arrest was subject to strict liability. The founders contemplated the enforcement of the common law to be a duty of private law enforcement and assumed the private law enforcers would represent their interests with private means. However, the founders viewed private individuals executing law enforcement duties as public authority. And remember, public is a word that's been stolen from us. It used to mean all of us. We are the public. Now it means the government that has the keys to the park, the public buildings and all that. In fact, public records like birth certificates are no longer public. And this was intended for the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to apply to such individuals when acting in their law enforcement capacities. Consequently, the Supreme Court's 1921 decision in Bordeaux versus McDowell often cited for the proposition that the Fourth Amendment applies only to government agents was almost certainly either wrongly decided or wrongly interpreted later in court. And what that found was, let's see, a corporate official, McDowell, who was fired by his employer for financial malfeasance at work. After McDowell's termination, company representatives raided his office, opened his safe, and rifled through his papers. Upon finding incriminating evidence against McDowell, company representatives alerted the United States Justice Department and turned over certain papers to the government. A district judge ordered the stolen papers returned to McDowell before they could be seen by a grand jury. The Supreme Court reversed, stating the Fourth Amendment was intended to restrain as a restraint upon the activities of sovereign authority and was not intended to be a limitation upon other than governmental agencies. So the employer could do it. The court, this is the first step. The court said that the employer went into his office and rifled through the papers and then turned them over. And the Supreme Court overruled the lower court that said you have to give the papers back to McDowell by saying that it only applies to government people, not to private people, the company. Now, that's contrary to what we learned earlier because we found that almost all warrants were served by private people. So, see, the court will do anything to manipulate to get the result they want. All they have to do is plausible deniability. All they got to do is come up with a good storyline and they win. They can't go wrong. Boy, we're fast running out of time, aren't we? Well, I'll tell you what, let's open it up to questions. There's, you know, I'm 80% through, but I can't get through the other 20%. So anybody got any questions on what we said? How about some of those people that say that, said early on before we started that LEOs are constitutional? Do you still believe that? Anybody?
They'll have to give a second to catch up on the stream so we can get in the chat room. We've been having some technical difficulties. Hopefully you're in the chat room. I've been unable to hold the internet connection to be in there myself.
There now, but it looks like the conversation is about butt ugly.
I think it's pretty clear from what's been stated this evening that they are, in fact, not constitutional. You know, it's been a bastardization, you know, that this has happened after the fact. This is not how things were when we started out. And it's had dire ramifications. And we've got to get back to what the framers intended.
Right, and it's even more important because if we don't know what our goal is, if we don't know what we're willing to fight for and perhaps give our lives for, it's kind of hard to be willing to fight and give your life for something. And so this gives us an idea of one of the things that we're fighting for, and it's to get rid of the police state that we've got. You know, one of the interesting story down in Waco, two people got kicked out of the press conference. First was a guy named Louis Bean. He asked a question, and that question was, is what's happening here in Waco indicative of the coming police state? They didn't answer him. They gave a signal to Officer Sims of the Waco Police Department. She got a couple of officers, and they went down and removed Louis Beam from the press conference at gunpoint. They never answered his question. Well, yeah, they did answer his questions. They just didn't answer it with words. When they took him out at gunpoint for asking, is this indicative of the coming police state, they used their guns to remove him from a press conference. By what right do they take somebody out of the press conference who's there to get answers to questions so that they can report on what's happening in Waco? Now, there's no doubt that the question was a bit suggestive. Now, I was removed, and the only question I ever asked in the press conference, and I wasn't removed for that question, was, is there any intention of contacting the Red Cross to provide food and health materials for the Davidians? And that was it. And the answer was no, by the way. And then when I called the Red Cross, they said, well, that's a crime scene. We can't go there. If it was war, we could go. It's a crime scene. We can't go.
That's ridiculous.
I would say so. So, yeah, we've got to know what our goal is. And our goal is to get back to where time will evolve things. Technology's changed. Things have changed. But we've got to get on the right path, which means the only way we're going to get there is to go back to what was then and then look around at technology and all this and say, what is appropriate? What can we do without demeaning our freedom, without demeaning our liberty and making them worthless as they are today? The only way is to get back there, because it's gone on a false course, and we've accepted that. And you know, I had a conversation about whether felons should be allowed in committee of safety or not. By what right does the government decide who cannot be or can be a participant in that government? If somebody goes to prison and serves their time and they get back out, they have as much right to vote as the man that never went to prison. I can't think of anything that would take that right away. So how is it that a committee of safety then can say, well, you can't be on our committee because you're a convicted felon? Well, I'm a convicted felon. I'll make the confession here on radio, on the internet radio. I am a convicted felon. I was arrested for possession of marijuana in 1969 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At the time, it was a felony. I was facing 2 years in prison because I was a Vietnam veteran. They nicely gave me 2 years probation, which I had to serve. But I am a convicted felon. It's on my record. When I went to become a surveyor in Florida, if I'd been convicted of a crime, it might have kept me from becoming a surveyor. I wrote a letter to the board explaining that it was not a crime of moral turpitude. They accepted that, and I got my license to practice surveying. But I'm a felon. So if we can judge, now what we've done, let's talk what judging is. Right now we allow certain people to judge who is going to go on the ballot. We've got a guy on the radio program, I can't think of his name right now, but he's in Pennsylvania, and he ran for governor as a write-in. He had too many hoops to jump.
Don
DeHaven. He had too many hoops to jump through. But the Democrats and Republicans never have a problem getting people on the ballot. They decide who you get to vote for. Now, what I tried to tell these people in the Committee of Safety, and he finally understood, is, Why do you have to exclude this guy? If he's a convicted felon and it's a bad crime, tell people he's a convicted felon. Here's what he's convicted for. And if you're honest, if you don't misrepresent him, don't say he was a child molester when all he did is shoot his dog or something, then let them decide. It's not yours to disqualify somebody. It's the voters to disqualify somebody. The government is not the powerful master. And that's a hard concept to get out of our minds, because we're so used to the fact that the government sets the rules. And so even in our venture back to what the Founding Fathers did, committees of safety, to retrace their steps to regain our country, we are so indoctrinated by society that we accept the provision that government can make these rules. We've got to get away from that. I don't see any questions popping up, so I guess either they're not listening or or something. So anyway, is it next Sunday? Is that when I'm on next?
I believe so, yeah.
Calendar. Okay, Sunday, April 10th.
Yes.
It's a tar and feather program. It's going to be about a committee of safety common law court. I think you might find it going to be one of the most worthwhile programs we've had on You Have Tread on Me, because this one is not what you might be able to do, or theory or history or anything else. This will be something that you can participate in after you've heard about it if you want to. The idea is to deal with one of the biggest problems we have in the Patriot community, and that's to get rid of the division and name-calling. So, next Sunday, bring your friends, you know, have a little beer party, sit around, and enjoy the show and find out how we can begin dealing with those two problems, division and the accusations. There's a remedy. It will solve the problem, I'm sure of that. Randy will have a lot to say about it, too, because he is participating early on in experimenting with the venture and dealing with that type of problem. And it will require participation as jurors. We need a clerk of the court. We need justices, and we need grand jurors. And those are volunteer positions. If anybody is interested in... Take it for a minute. Let me find my link, Dave.
No problem. Definitely want to check this out. This should be very productive, and hopefully we can start solving some of these problems you were talking about. And something like this Dave, is definitely needed.
Dave's a behind-the-scenes player in this whole thing, but he's involved in it as well. Okay, here's the link. Now, all the detail isn't up what the duties are, but if anybody's interested in volunteering to serve on this court, there's the URL. And you can go to that page. Let's see. I guess we could put the... We'll put the forum up as well, if I can find it. And the forum right now is in the test mode, but you're welcome to go there and look around. And the URL to it is... right here. Now, those of you who haven't heard about it before, if you go to the first link I gave you, the top link on that page will tell you about what the purpose of the court is and how it's going to operate. The bottom link is where you can submit your name to be a volunteer. The second link I just gave you, the first one was to court at Outpost of Freedom. The second one's to Liberty Tree, a forum where the courts will actually be held.
Can you go ahead and read those out aloud so it will be in the archive, so when people are listening to this on the archive and they don't have access to the chat room, they'll be able to go to those links?
Okay, for the forum, the Liberty Tree Forum, which also deals, it has an area for committees of safety and Sons of Liberty at the Green Dragon Inn, but it also has a common law courthouse. It is at www.committee.org/LibertyTree. That's committee.org/IBERTY. committee.org/LibertyTree. The other site where you can volunteer and read about the forum is, I got to go back and find that one now. It'd be easier to go back in the chat, I guess. Windows is, Internet Explorer is acting funny. It just locks up for no reason sometimes now.
I think they actually spent a good deal of engineering time and dollars adding that feature.
Okay, the other URL is www.committee.org/CourT. So it's committee.org/court with an uppercase C on court. Everything else is lowercase. I wish they'd get over that uppercase, lowercase on URL addresses, but
It's all about the file systems being case sensitive, and that's, you know, probably not going to go away anytime soon. You know, there's a few ways to trick the web servers into not being case sensitive, but that ends up causing compatibility problems elsewhere.
Well, since you can't give the same URL whether it's upper or lower case, I don't see why they have the distinction. Because they won't grant it regardless of the case structure. In fact, I guess some people have bought in the different variations. Even.
Well, as far as the domain names, yes. It doesn't matter whether or not you capitalize, you know, committee or .org or any of that as far as the host name is concerned. But once you get to the first slash, everything beyond that is case sensitive. Because that refers to files on the web server, and the files are case sensitive.
Okay, Cav, that it has nothing to do with CCOM, nothing at all. This has to do with committees of safety. The idea was inspired by my studying the committees of safety and knowing what they did. Thank you, Cav. What they did back then to deal with certain problems, they dealt with some problems, not with others. We're dealing with something a little bit different. It's scheduled for the show on the 10th, but I'll give you a little insight. There is no punishment. There's no fines. There's no stocks in the public square. There's no hanging at sunrise. All it is going to be a verdict. And the verdict will be well thought out and well presented, whether somebody is guilty or not of the charges brought against them. So do come back next Sunday for Tar and Feathering Committees of Safety Common Law Court. I want to thank you all for listening tonight and hope you will find the time to read the, let me paste it one more time, the Our Cops Constitutional, and I'll read it as well. For those that come later, the URL for that is www.outpost.freedom.com/blog/?p=337. So that's outpostoffreedom.com/blog/?p=337. And then you'll have an idea what we're fighting for. So thank you all for listening. Dave, thanks for taking Randy's place as host tonight and filling in my...
Oh, not a problem. It was a great show. It was very, very interesting, and it's definitely something that we need to carefully consider because all these things happen to us gradually enough. We don't often look back far enough to see what the contrast, you know, between how things were intended to be by the framers and where we've gotten today. It's very, very crucial to have these things in mind so we know which direction we need to go. So when we're in the process of restoring our republic, we know how we need to have things set up. We also have another special program scheduled for Wednesday. We're having an economist on. We're going to be talking about the banks, the economy, and getting down into the nitty-gritty of that. It should be a really good show. It's a special show for Wednesday, so you know, just throwing that out there now. And again, definitely check back with us next Sunday for the Tar and Feather program so we can talk about these common law courts. Anyway, I guess that's where we'll leave off for tonight. Everyone take care. Stay free.